Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, rallies both for and against gay marriage will take place here in Massachusetts, marking the one-year anniversary of the legalization of same-sex marriage. More than 6,000 mainly lesbian partners have tied the knot here in the Bay State. Polls show increasing support for the couples. The state Democratic Party has adopted gay marriages in its party platform, and an effort in the state house to ban them may be fading. But nationwide, there's a different picture. A recent Boston Globe poll shows that half of Americans don't want their states to recognize gay marriages from Massachusetts, and many states are considering ballot questions to ban gay marriages altogether, including Arizona, where yesterday a signature gathering campaign kicked off. Well, joining us in the studio for a review is Here Now's Fred Tice. Fred, today you reported on out-of-state couples coming here to Massachusetts to get married. We thought there was a state law that prevented that.
There is a law that prevents it for now, and what's happening is that gay and lesbian advocates and defenders, the people who managed to get gay marriage recognized in Massachusetts, are suing to have that law declared unconstitutional, because they're saying if the Massachusetts Constitution guarantees gay marriage, it really doesn't matter once you're in Massachusetts, you know, where you live. So that argument will go before the state Supreme Court next September.
Well, now moving to Arizona, as we mentioned, it's looking to move this question to a referendum, but it's not the only state where voters are going to cast ballots on whether to change their constitutions to ban same-sex marriages. How many other states are considering this?
There are 15 states that are considering this at this point. There are four states, including Massachusetts, where the legislature has to pass this two consecutive sessions in a row, and then it goes to the voters, they've approved it once. Those other states are Wisconsin, Indiana, and Virginia. And then there are three states where the legislatures are all done. They've done everything they have to. They've approved it. All it has to do is go to the voters, and those are South Dakota, Alabama, and Tennessee. And
so to be clear, there is still a chance in Massachusetts that this law legalizing same-sex marriages might be overturned?
Yeah, there is that chance. I mean, sometime in August, the legislature will consider this constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage and establish civil unions.
It's pretty polarized here in the state, too.
It is, and what's happening is that the opponents of gay marriage, rather, are backing away from this compromise amendment that would have established civil unions and banned gay marriage. They're figuring that maybe, you know, at this point, we have gay marriage in Massachusetts. They might as well go for what they really want, which is an all-out ban on gay marriage. So it's looking less and less likely that this constitutional amendment will pass.
Well, so are supporters of same-sex marriage concerned? I mean, it seems as if this has been a backlash since the law in Massachusetts legalizing gay marriage.
You've certainly seen a big backlash in the November elections last year, where you had 16 states pass some sort of either law or constitutional amendment banning gay marriage, and then recently Kansas approved a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. And that's all seems to be a reaction to the fact that Massachusetts legalized gay marriage last year.
And we want to touch on Nebraska. The Conservative Family Research Council is making much of a federal judge, a Clinton appointee in Nebraska, who last week struck down that state's constitutional amendment defining marriage as between one man and one woman. That judge said it was motivated by irrational fear of homosexuals. Do you see ripple effects from that ruling?
Absolutely. The opponents of gay marriage are incensed by this ruling. It's the first time that a federal judge has ruled a state constitutional amendment banning gay marriage to be unconstitutional under the federal constitution. Now, it's not clear whether there's going to be applications whether federal judges in other states would be able to do this. It appears that Nebraska's constitutional amendment was particularly badly worded. It was too broad, and it was very vulnerable to being overturned by a federal judge. And, of course, opponents of gay marriage are going to appeal this Nebraska case.
And before we let you go, we've talked about states where there's a move to ban gay marriage. What about states where there's a move to make it legal?
There are seven states where people are trying to do the same thing that happened in Massachusetts, which is get the courts to declare that gay marriage is legal under the state constitution. And the state where that's the most advanced is the state of Washington, where the state Supreme Court is getting ready to hear arguments in that case.
So it sounds as if at least a year on, one person who has benefited in this issue is the lawyer
Good
involved
point.
In all these cases. Here now is Fred Tice, who's been covering the same-sex marriage story since the marriages became legal in Massachusetts 1 year ago today. Fred, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
A year and a half after he was arrested, Saddam Hussein languishes under guard in Iraq awaiting trial. He reportedly has lost weight but remains energetic and defiant. Meanwhile, 2,000 lawyers from around the world have volunteered to defend the former Iraqi president and other top figures in his regime. Leading this unwieldy legal team is a gray-haired, dignified, and outraged Jordanian lawyer, Ziad al-Kaskouni. Journalist William Langevisha spent months following the progress of Saddam's lawyers and wrote about them for the June issue of the Atlantic Monthly, and he joins us now on the line from Amman, Jordan. Welcome, William.
Thank you.
Well, right at the outset, you list some fascinating theories Mr. Al-Kaskouni holds about the U.S. Can you share some of those and give us a sense of this man?
Well, first of all, I mean, Ziad is a very dignified guy. He's a middle-class Jordanian lawyer, educated, and as I say, he's not a fool. So I think that you have to start with that. Having said that, in the context, he has told me on occasion that, for instance, he believes that many American deaths, U.S. deaths, are being hidden by the U.S. Military in Iraq, that American bodies are being dumped out of airplanes into the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, that you can go to a certain place in the desert. In fact, he knows a shepherd who has gone to a certain place in the desert and has become a rich man because he picks up all the rings and watches that are somehow stripped off the bodies before. These are of American soldiers before they're dumped by the U.S. military into the river. He believes that something like 20,000 U.S. soldiers were wiped out by the tsunami and that this has been covered up in Indonesia or someplace near there.
And the list is topped with his belief that in reality Saddam Hussein was captured several months before he was found in the hole, and that was just sort of a publicity stunt by the Americans.
That he was drugged and he was put on drugs and then paraded in front of the cameras in the condition that he was in, that this was a condition created by a conspiracy of American authorities.
And he sincerely believes these things, and as you write, more important, he probably reflects widespread belief in these things.
I mean, I think that's what's interesting. Look, he's not a stupid man, and it's important to understand that. He's not just some flake. It would be too easy to dismiss him that way. He's not a person to be dismissed. In fact, I think that he's important because he does represent a large swath of Arab thinking about the U.S. presence in Iraq and about specifically about Saddam Hussein and these coming trials. And so people are prone to believe in conspiracies in a big way in this part of the world.
Well, how is Ziad expecting to mount a defense for Saddam Hussein?
Well, it's not clear. I think it's not clear to him. Right now, the defense he's mounting is largely a political defense and in the media or trying to, making a lot of noise. And it has some effects. But until recently, none of the defense attorneys have been allowed to speak to Saddam or to any of the other defendants. And they have not been given access to the evidence, even to the rules of evidence and the procedures that will be used in this special tribunal in Baghdad. So they've been very much at a loss. I mean, they've been excluded. They've been very much on the outside. And by the way, Ziad is not in Baghdad. He doesn't dare go there. Most of these attorneys don't dare go to Baghdad. Their lives would be at risk. And there's no protection being offered to them. So Ziad is in Amman, and that's a long way from Baghdad.
2,000 lawyers, as we've said, have contacted him and volunteered to be part of a defense team. There's not 2,000 international lawyers gathered in Amman with him on this team.
No, in fact, none of these lawyers are international lawyers to begin with. To a large degree, they're Arab lawyers who know basically their own local laws. There are some European lawyers. There are some American lawyers. And I think there are some Japanese. They're people who are basically believe in the cause politically or simply are looking for publicity and have jumped onto this bandwagon. It's silly, obviously, 2,000 lawyers, though I could never get Mr. Ziad to admit to me that it's silly, frankly. But within that, there are about a dozen or two dozen lawyers who form the core team. What that means at this point remains largely a mystery. Again, there has been very little for Ziad and these defense lawyers to work with.
Staying with this team of lawyers, it includes American Ramsey Clark, a former French foreign minister, and Libyan leader Gaddafi's daughter.
Ziad has told me that she's actually one of the core people, though I've heard from others that many on the team consider her to be somewhat of an embarrassment. She's a very flashy woman, very good looking in a sort of Riviera style, and she seems to be positioning herself politically within Libya, and I would assume is using this as a publicity stunt.
And you went to visit the former foreign French minister, Roland Dumas, and your conclusion was that he was just sort of enjoying the attention, but he also probably wasn't going to have much of a function. But former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who's joined the team, what purpose might he serve?
Ramsey Clark is an interesting and complicated guy, as I'm sure you know. He's very controversial. That's not the point. But his motives are a little difficult to decipher. He's a very decent person, in person, honorable, obviously. I think his political judgment has at times been questionable. That's not necessarily the case here. I mean, Saddam and these others do need defense. What can he bring to this team? I suppose what he can bring is some knowledge of the American court system. But beyond that, it's not clear to me. He brings fame, of course.
Well, and as you point out in your article, Ramsey Clark has served as legal counsel to Saddam in the past, but now he makes the point that a fair trial for Saddam is in America's interest. But we keep getting back to, how is that going to happen? How is Ziad's team going to mount their defense? Who's paying for it?
Well, I asked Ziad that question many times, and what he has told me is that it's all pro bono. No one's paying for it because there's no money involved. Now, I'm very skeptical about that. There's evidence of that his predecessor at the head of this defense team may have walked off with several hundred thousand dollars. Where that money comes from or came from, I don't know, if indeed that's true, and I have no way of knowing if it really is, but there was a fallout within the team because of that. Ziad really would not address that with me at all. I think there is a general belief that there's plenty of money around to defend these people. This, after all, is the old regime, and the old regime was rich. I mean, these people were certainly rolling in oil revenues, and we can assume that they took some money and put it aside. It could be used for these purposes.
Journalist William Langevisha. He writes about Saddam's lawyers for the June issue of Atlantic Monthly. Tell you what, stay right there. When we come back, we're going to hear more about Saddam's legal team. Also, British MP George Galloway gives a tongue-lashing today to members of Congress who say that he profited illegally from the oil for food program in Iraq. We'll hear a little bit of that testifying today before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. Stay with us. Much more ahead, coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continue our conversation about Ziad Al-Qassani, the Jordanian lawyer who's leading Saddam Hussein's defense team. We're speaking with journalist William Langevisha. And William, you've said that Ziad is a very smart, dignified man. What is motivating him? How does he feel about Saddam Hussein?
Genuine political anger, just like what is motivating the insurrection in Iraq. He's emotionally and politically closely tied to the insurgents. And the anger is very real. This is not, they're not playing pretend, as I think the daily news reports let us know. These people are very, very serious, and they are very, very angry. And it is not just within Iraq. It is here in Jordan. I happen to be in Amman right now tonight. And it's elsewhere in the Arab world and to some degree elsewhere in the world. Of course, the famous question, does he really believe that Saddam is innocent? In a way, that's irrelevant. it's all about opposing the United States and this invasion of Iraq. So we're talking about very serious political anger.
And also love. You say nearly filial love, that Ziad referred to Saddam Hussein as the caring one, and his eyes shine when he speaks of him. He's a deep love for him.
Well, he's either a very good actor as a defense attorney, and he may be, or he really is in love with Saddam Hussein. He certainly gives all the appearances of truly loving the man, which is, of course, a little hard to understand for those of us who are not in love with Saddam Hussein.
Let's talk about how he expressed to you, even though they haven't really mounted a defense, Saddam's legal team, led by Ziad, but they have been, you know, searching the internet for things that make their point. For instance, at one point he said to you, "I read it on the internet. Tony Blair has said that mass graves are a lie," which kind of, you know, drives home the point that they're not really sharing information with the prosecution team. They don't seem to have any other information but what they're sort of scrounging for on the internet or in the rumor mill.
Well, I mean, the terrible thing about the internet in the world today is that it sort of reinforces ignorance. As we all know, you can find whatever you want on the internet. Mr. Ziad spends a lot of time clearly reading a certain internet site that I became familiar with, an insurgent site, in fact, where he himself issues his press announcements and proclamations. And that site is a study in wild misthinking. The other point, though, which is that the defense team is not getting access to the real stuff on the ground, is very real and is a very large problem for us in the United States. I mean, what we're looking at right now is certainly the foundation of a public relations disaster.
Well, in fact, you say that he represents a lot of people, and in shutting him out, excluding him, from the pretrial preparations, it may end up empowering him and playing into Saddam's hands.
Well, I think that there are various ironies at play here. I mean, it's perfectly understandable why the beleaguered Iraqi tribunal people in Baghdad and the beleaguered American advisors to the tribunal have excluded this man and his people, because there's clearly a circus element. I mean, he's too rhetorical, he's too ignorant as to the specifics. There's too much bombast going on. Who would want to get involved with a circus like this? I mean, people say in Baghdad, these guys aren't serious. These aren't the real players. The problem is that, circus or not, Ziad is the audience that we, with this tribunal, need to address. It's unfortunate that we haven't seen the political courage and wisdom necessary to understand that and to reach out to this guy. There should have been a massive effort to provide Ziad with lots of help, money, space, and access to the defendants and access to the logic of the prosecution and to the material that will be used in the trial. None of this has happened.
William Langovici, where is Saddam now? What's he doing with his time?
I don't know where he is. He's in Iraq. He's not far from Baghdad. He's on a U.S. military base. He is in a little house, well guarded, obviously, alone. He's been alone, unlike the others who have been allowed to get together, I think, daily. He gardens, and he reads the Quran, or at least says that he does, and he writes some poetry, and I suppose he spends a lot of time sleeping and thinking. I'm sure that he is totally unbowed and probably believes that he will somehow, in some way, master the situation. And, you know, if for instance, he's sentenced to death and is taken out and hung or shot, that's not necessarily the worst thing that can happen to a guy like Saddam.
William Langovici, his article on the lawyers who will defend Saddam Hussein appears in the June issue of the Atlantic Monthly. William, thank you.
Thank you.
Who paid me hundreds of thousands of dollars of money? The answer to that is nobody. And if you had anybody who ever paid me a penny, you would have produced them here today.
That's George Galloway, British Member of Parliament, testifying in Washington today before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. The Senate panel has accused Galloway and others of profiting from the United Nations Oil for Food program that was in place in Iraq before the fall of Saddam Hussein. Galloway angrily told the Senate to consider their source of information.
You have my name on lists provided to you by the Dofer inquiry provided to him by the convicted bank robber and fraudster and con man Ahmed Chalabi, who many people, to their credit in your country, now realize played a decisive role in leading your country into the disaster in Iraq.
The Senate committee said documents indicate Saddam gave Galloway the rights to export 20 million barrels of oil under the now-defunct humanitarian program in return for Galloway's vocal opposition to international sanctions and the American-led effort to overthrow Saddam. And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, the debate over activist judges comes to a head in the U.S. Senate. And why is the CPB getting tough on NPR and PBS? We'll have more on this alphabet soup. That's tomorrow. But stay with us. There's much more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Mexico has one of the world's greatest diversities of plants, and for generations, Mexican Indians have developed cures using these plants. But when the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect just over 10 years ago, it opened the door to foreign businesses, and international drug companies in search of new medicines began approaching the Mexican Indians. Our series on globalization continues with this look at the clash that resulted between the Mexican Indians and the foreign drug firms. Mary Stuckey has the story.
In the town of San Cristobal, in the state of Chiapas in southern Mexico, is a small apothecary where people come for medicine. The medicine here is made from plants grown in a garden outside. Indian healers grind the leaves into powders. The medicines are stacked in bottles on wooden shelves. On this day, an Indian woman from the nearby highlands has come for medicine. She speaks in one of the local Maya languages and studies a handwritten chart on the wall. The chart lists ailments from eye infections to diabetes to baldness. Antonio Perez is the Indian healer in charge of the apothecary.
We help people. We support people who need help because people don't have a way to get money to buy medicine at the pharmacy. We believe that these plants should be made known to people who are suffering from pain.
Near the apothecary is the office of Micaela Eco Bautista. She works with Indian midwives who go out into hundreds of remote villages helping women who may never have the chance to see a doctor. The midwives use plant medicines for troubles like difficult labor and menstrual cramps. Eco sits at her desk wearing a blue velvet skirt, her long black hair tied back with a green satin ribbon.
Women learn about things among themselves, and that's how the conversations go. I am sick, my heart hurts, my head hurts, my stomach hurts, I'm pregnant. I've cured myself in this way. Let's take this. This is the dose. They do this by talking among themselves.
It's not just the locals who are interested in plant medicines. Drug companies and researchers from all over the world have come to Mexico in search of cures based on plants. In 1998, the U.S. National Institutes of Health announced a $2.5 million study of what the Maya Indians know about medicinal plants. The hope was to find plant cures with commercial value. This is a bit like mining, not for gold, but for plants. It's sometimes called bioprospecting. Also involved in the project, a British drug company and researchers from two universities, one in Mexico and the other the University of Georgia, where Brent Berlin works as an anthropologist.
The use of the biological resources that indigenous local populations have available to them is, in my view, their best option to be able to actively participate in the benefits of globalization. The Haile Maya have the traditional knowledge of the medicinal use of these plants. They do not have the technical skills And this is something that could have been brought to bear by Western biological science.
At the time the project was announced, the person in charge of protecting Mexico's vast plant resources was an ecologist by the name of Jorge Soberón. Soberón says the medicinal plant project was a golden opportunity for the Indians, most of them among the poorest people in Mexico.
The terms that Brent Berlin had obtained from the company were fantastic, very good, the best I've ever seen. Normally, you get 2%, 3%, 5% of royalties. And this contract got something in the order of 15 or 20%. It was very good. We're not going to take out of poverty the Mexican Indians, but that particular set of communities was going to get an improvement.
One of those Indian communities is about an hour from San Cristobal. It's called Pacbilna. The village is nestled in a highland valley. One- and two-room houses, about 300 of them, are scattered at the base of steep mountains. Wildflowers bloom near fields of corn and beans. The air smells of sage. On this Sunday morning, Rafael Encinos is just leaving church. He's lived all his life in Pacbilna and explains that the medicinal plant project offered his poor village much-needed money. For a while, he says, the people here worked with the project. But then, he says, it came to a sudden stop, and the people were never told why.
We are poor, but they forgot about us and pulled out. So many things they were going to give us, but we don't know. We want to know where they went.
The forces that stopped the project are back in San Cristobal. An activist group mobilized the fight. The group is run by Juan Ignacio, a lawyer from Mexico City. Ignacio says he told the Indians that gringos from the north were trying to trick them.
If they want to come here and get plants, it has to be according to our system. It's not about money. Medicine is for everyone. We don't want it to be under a patent.
Ignacio says he told the Indians that big foreign drug companies planned to patent the plants, so the medicine would only be available if people had a lot of money to pay. That frightened Micaela Ico, the Maya woman who works with the midwives.
They, the foreigners, come in and talk to us, and they talk to us about plants and everything our God gave us. The sacred land, the stones, the rocks. Someday we won't have anything left.
Opposition to the bioprospecting deal grew fierce, both inside and outside of Mexico. In the end, the Mexican government killed the project by refusing to grant a permit. Now the Mexican Congress is considering a new bioprospecting law meant to sort out the thorniest issues. Issues like how to share any profits that come from selling the medicine, and how to get proper consent from all of the Indian communities who lay claim to the plants, perhaps thousands of villages. Those are enormous hurdles, says Luis Garcia, a biologist at the university in San Cristobal. Garcia worked on the medicinal plant project. He says it was simply too big. But the Indians and even the world beyond Mexico lost a lot.
If you bring together groups which have very different cultures, very different economic and social power, well, you have to be very patient and say, let's do it little by little.
Even then, it might not be possible to bridge the gap. In the United States, drug companies see nothing wrong with patenting a plant, making medicine, and selling it around the world. While many Indians can't imagine owning a living thing, what they consider to be a gift from God. 3.5 years after the collapse of the Maya Medicine Project, the two cultures are still far apart. Today, not a single foreigner is bioprospecting anywhere in Mexico.
That's Mary Stuckey reporting a story that's part of Think Global, Public Radio's week of special coverage of globalization. And still to come, her measurements are a back-breaking 39-18-34. A life-size Barbie teaches teens about body image. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Yesterday, we spoke with Peter Goslin of the Los Angeles Times. After finding that 11 Nobel Prize-winning economists hadn't done well on their own retirement portfolios, Peter drew the conclusion that average Americans would have a hard time investing their Social Security returns under President Bush's proposed plan. Well, Frika Etta of Baton Rouge, Louisiana writes, "Your piece was revealing, but I see no reason to abandon Bush's plan just because some academics failed to adapt theory to reality. For inspiration, I would prefer to look to billionaire Warren Buffett rather than Nobel Prize winner Markowitz." Well, we also spoke again recently with Oscar Vasquez, the illegal immigrant who won a major science award in high school and supports pending federal legislation called the DREAM Act that would put illegal immigrants on a fast track to a green card if they go to college or serve in the military. Many of you wrote opposed to fast-tracking illegal immigrants, but Cressy Rice of Phoenix had a different concern. She writes, "I was an English teacher in Oscar's school district. You talked about college, but many of Oscar's fellow classmates have been choosing the military option. They can become citizens and benefit from the military's programs. The U.S. military machine is on our campuses through the junior ROTC programs that provide a military culture for students as young as 13. September 11th brought students together to care about our country and others' lives, but attacking Iraq brought a solemn drum of uncertainty to all the junior ROTC students I knew. Was it worth dying for them to gain their citizenship?" Well, many of you wrote to thank us for our story on Judy Wicks, owner of Philadelphia's White Dog Cafe, who subsidizes a local pig farmer who raises animals humanely and boasts a cruelty-free menu featuring only meat from free-range animals, for instance. Well, vegetarians were split on the idea. We had this phone message from Jordan Gallagher.
The viewpoint of the woman that owns the restaurant where people can eat animals that have been decently raised instead of cooped up and mistreated in factory farms was a step in the right direction.
But we had this dissent from Richard Anton of Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
Regardless of the owner's politics, if animals or sea life died and wound up on the plate, or were killed and wound up on the plate, it wasn't cruelty-free. You can pat a sheep's head, you know, as many times as you want, but once you've cut its throat, it didn't die a humane death. It would have been more humane to let the animal live.
Well, we also heard from many of you after our conversation with Jane Fonda. Most were appreciative. Sat Kalsa of Millis, Massachusetts writes, "Jane Fonda is an American hero. I served in the U.S. Air Force from June of 68 to October of 1970 and was honorably discharged. I worked after I left the service to bring vets of the Vietnam War together with other activists to help stop the war. I now serve as chaplain of Post 208 in Millis to honor the veterans of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. We still need folks like Jane to elevate our hearts, to heal our minds, and inspire the young to care about true values of liberty." But George Norton, listening in Gibbsboro, New Jersey, was furious at Jane Fonda's contention that while she regretted being photographed on an enemy gun, she did not regret her trip to Hanoi in 1972. George writes, "She makes me sick to my stomach. I'm old enough to have lived through the Vietnam era, but too old to have served then, as I had already done my part during the Korean conflict. For her to dispute even the liberal media's coverage at that time of her treasonous actions and degradation of our country goes beyond propriety. I believe in freedom of speech, but you don't have to give a megaphone to an idiot." Well, finally, Richard Foster wrote to ask, "What was the song you played at the end of your piece on trucker ministers?" It was Little Walter's Key to the Highway, and here's some more of it.
I got the key to the highway. Built out and bound to go. I'm gonna leave here running because walking is most too slow. I'm going back to the border where I'm better known.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With this update on a story we brought you recently, the American Civil Liberties Union is suing the federal government for allegedly using tax dollars to spread Christianity through an abstinence program called the Silver Ring Thing. The ACLU says the program encourages young people to commit themselves to Jesus Christ and that those who complete the program sign a covenant before God Almighty. The program does encourage young men and women to remain abstinent until marriage. They receive a silver ring inscribed with the words, "God wants you to be holy, so you should keep clear of sexual sin." And the founder of the Silver Ring Thing says his program is using federal dollars properly. That lawsuit was filed in Boston federal court yesterday.
Good food! Yeah. Very good food!
It's lunchtime at the Beaver Country Day School in the Boston suburb of Chestnut Hill. Middle school students are jockeying for position in the cafeteria line, the hot commodity, tater tots.
I always need my tots.
Hey, you gotta get the tater tots with the ketchup.
As the kids in line load up on carbs, another group clusters around a different attraction.
Oh my god, that's a little creepy.
Awesome.
What is that?
That's wrong.
That is just
that, that's not right. That's really not right.
That's disgusting.
That is disgusting.
That's gross.
The students are reacting to a life-size papier-mâché Barbie doll. The South Shore Eating Disorder Collaborative from Easton, Massachusetts, built this 5'9" mannequin to raise awareness about body image and out-of-control dieting. They call her the Get Real Barbie, and she's quite a sight, decked out in a skimpy miniskirt and halter top with proportions that would literally kill a real person. 39-inch chest, 18-inch waist, and 34-inch hips.
If Barbie was blown up to the size of what she would be in real life, this is what she would look like.
Yeah, but no one wants.
What do you think?
Ew.
Oh my.
Her legs are like my wrist.
I mean,
look at that.
Like we're like that's you're just, thin. We're thin, but we're not like thin.
That's disgusting. Just the comparison. That's not even pretty.
That's exactly the response Kathleen Burns Kingsbury was looking for when her organization dreamed up the Get Real Barbie. The doll stops teens in their tracks and gets them to start talking about body image.
Do you think your friends or people you know would want to look like her?
My sister did for like 4 years. Seeing the little one, they do, but seeing her like this, that's gross.
Lunchtime is a good time for Barbie to visit because that's when students first start to notice if something isn't quite right with how much or how little their friends are eating.
I see certain girls and how much they eat, at lunch or even throughout the day, or if they don't eat and you look at their weight and you see what's going on and you're just wondering just why. That's just the question I ask. I just sit back and I just wonder why. You know, like how small do you want to make yourself?
I definitely notice girls in this school, particularly, they're taking the diet thing a little too crazy. Like half a cracker lunch isn't really a diet.
Jessica Cunningham and Beth Mayer of the Massachusetts Eating Disorder Association say they notice that children are beginning to worry about their weight at much younger ages.
These sixth grade girls especially are very concerned what they look like. They're very preoccupied with their bodies and with dressing their bodies in a way that's desirable, both to the young boys in the grade, but also to the young girls so that they don't get mocked or made fun of. And I think that's one of the key points is these sixth graders are, the girls are very aware of what the other girls are thinking of them. And we're starting to see kids at 7, 8, 9 years old with frequency coming in with severe body disturbance issues or eating disorder issues.
That was Jessica, and Beth Mayer agrees.
Clinically and as a teacher, I see that kids are starting to fiddle with their bodies as their bodies are supposed to change naturally. And basically what people can do is diet into obesity. So you keep dieting, and then you regain the weight, and you regain one, and you stop having a sense of where your hunger is. And what your needs are.
So you're saying that they're just throwing their internal barometers off. By dieting, they're actually gaining weight.
Yes, that people can diet themselves and lose weight. And what we know about diets is 95% of diets don't work for children and adults. If you're living in a culture where people look at you and give you the eye when you're having a chocolate sundae when you're 10 years old, then that's going to change your relationship with food and your body. And you're going to feel like, what's wrong with me that I want that?
My name is Kathleen Burns Kingsbury, and I'm here today representing the South Shore Eating Disorder Collaborative and the Get Real Barbie.
And Beth, we're along with Jessica, and Kathleen bring the Get Real Barbie to schools around the state as part of a body image curriculum.
So we just wanted to get your reactions today to what you think of Get Real Barbie and what you think about the media and body image and how it impacts you.
I am Dan Katz, ninth grade at Fever Country Day School. Well, I feel there's obviously the ideal, you know, woman that every guy wants to be to have.
Ooh, tell me what the ideal woman is.
Well, the stereotypical, obviously. Well, it's kind of, you know, the stick thin. I think that stereotype has also gone down over the years. Uh-huh. I think it's improved a lot, but it's definitely still out there.
I don't know if you guys know what's happened to G.I. Joe, too, over the past, I think it's about 15, 20 years, but his biceps have gotten considerably bigger. What do you see the pressures being like for guys?
I think especially with males, I think there's even more and more pressure coming on lately with body image. Obviously, muscles, I think, would be the key thing. And I think that's also in conjunction with a lot of the issues you see around with, like, athletes using steroids and everything. I think they're really worried about a lot of young boys that are want to take steroids to get themselves bigger.
So what do you think about those new shows, all that Dr. 90210 and I Want a Famous Face and Extreme Makeover?
When you look at the last episode of America's Top Model, I believe one of the judges told a girl that she had to lose about 5 to 15 pounds, and it was okay. No one said anything like, wow, that's like really wrong or it's rude or anything. It was all right. They were like, oh, wow, I really have to lose that 15 pounds. And I mean, that's crazy that people should be watching shows where it's okay for someone to say, I want to change myself, like drastically, I want to go do some plastic surgery, and it's accepted as the norm.
What is the perfect man and the perfect woman supposed to be like, in addition to the physical aspect?
Jessica Cunningham struggled with her own eating disorder, and she draws on that personal experience when working with kids.
I try to impart to them what it feels like to have an eating disorder, how exhausting it is, how anxiety-producing it is, how it eliminates your chance for doing so many other things in life at that time period. I really try to emphasize the level of depression at that time so that they can say to themselves, having that kind of body isn't worth the kind of pain.
Well, as lunch winds down at the Beaver Country Day School, the tater tots are all but history, the vegetable bin overflowing, and the Get Real Barbie still turning heads.
I thought she was pretty, but I guess not anymore. She's fat.
Danny, look at the hips.
I know, she's the biggest hips in the world.
Her waist is like... her waist is really small.
Like, can you fit your hands around it?
Almost. You can almost fit your hands around it. It puts a size 10, which is like an average size woman, has a 28 and a half inch waist.
How big's her waist?
Her waist is 18 inches.
So imagine taking 10 inches off your waist.
Ow.
A lot of the kids were concerned about her health and wanting to feed her and feeling like she was kind of scary looking because she was so thin. And that's what helps us really talk about the issues, because when you bring it to life size like that, it becomes real. It becomes more real, like, hey, if we want to look like Barbie, this is what she'd look like. Do we really want to look like that, or do we want to look like ourselves? Some of the young boys said they wouldn't date her.
Our recent visit to the Beaver Country Day School in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts, was produced by Kevin Sullivan. We spoke to Kathleen Burns Kingsbury of the South Shore Eating Disorder Collaborative, makers of the Get Real Barbie, and Jessica Cunningham and Beth Mayer of the Massachusetts Eating Disorder Association. For pictures of Barbie, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Matt Largie, Stefano Katsonis, Karen Miller-Medson, and Emiko Tamagawa. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Deborah Becker. Our interns are Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.